Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. George H.W. Bush died last week, leaving an extensive legacy of public service from his stint as a Navy pilot in World War II to his one term in the Oval Office and as the titular head of the Republican Party. Joining us to talk about that and more is our weekly reporter roundtable, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Joe.
It's great to be here.
And Columbus Dispatch reporter Kathy Kandisky. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And Associated Press State House correspondent Julie Carr-Smith. Welcome as always.
Hi, Ann.
How has the party changed since George H.W. Bush was in charge?
I
remember when Clinton beat him. In his effort to get a second term, but
one of my most vivid memories is when they had the debate in Cleveland, and you'll recall, I think 16 candidates were flanked across the stage debating for the nomination. Reince Priebus came out, and he was then the head of the party, and he looked up at George H.W. Bush in the balcony, and he said. President Bush.
Wait a minute, was
President Bush, I bet you don't envy me how the party has changed. I mean, in the sense that we used to have party bosses who were deciding these things. I mean, that started to become a political football that people would toss back and forth. Oh, this is all insider. We need to let the voters decide.
Yeah, politics.
Back room,
mm-hmm.
smoky, cigar-filled room deals. But in a sense, it was a more dignified process. It was based on qualifications that the party decided, and as of this last time, it was a bit of a free for all. Obviously, we got a nominee that our own governor kind of boycotted, that many people aren't necessarily supportive of, or if they love him, they still sometimes don't think he's qualified in areas.
You know, George H.W. Epitomized to me a very particular period of time when it seems like all the former presidents were friends. They got along.
Well, I think his friendship with Bill Clinton, who of course defeated him and denied him a second term, speaks volumes about his character. And I think they genuinely were true friends. He certainly comes from an era of true statesmanship and well-behaved, you know, certainly compared to today, much more well-behaved political process.
Yeah. And the fact that they all got along, I mean, the ones that are left still do, but apparently no love lost with Barbara Bush. The president wasn't invited to her funeral, but this is, of course, a state funeral.
Right, right. And I think President Bush probably realized that as well, that this is a state funeral and that's what makes it different. But, you know, I've kind of got to wonder in the back of his mind if he didn't kind of share some of Barbara Bush's feelings of disdain toward President Trump.
Well, he didn't vote for him. He's right. Openly said he voted for Hillary Clinton.
Right. And I think honestly, if you think about it, during the Bush era, some of the things that President Trump does and says and the way he behaves would not have been tolerated at all during the Bush era. And I think that's distasteful to some of these politicians, Republicans who have been around for a very long time, to see where it's gone. Back in George H.W. Bush's era, there wasn't Twitter. They didn't have all this social media. And you certainly weren't out there behaving in a way, you know, President Trump is daily calling someone a name or, you know, taking someone on. That wasn't the way that they handled things back then. And I think there's a certain sense that decorum has been lost with the presidency. And so I'm kind of looking forward to seeing how the dynamics, how this actually plays out, because I think, you know, George H.W. Bush, President Bush, probably realizes that, you know, it's a presidential thing, that all the presidents need to be there. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that he puts them all in the same category, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, and a key thing was that, in that letter that circulated this weekend that George H.W. Bush wrote to his successor, you know, it was always the case that once you're elected, you're everyone's president. You're the president of every single American. You don't call the members of the opposite party evil. You try to uphold the greatest respect for every American because now you're their president. And, you know, that was the way succession went. And when you lost and you said, well, now they're the president. And even George H.W. said of Clinton, you know, now you're my president and I wish you the best for the sake of the country. And so that divisiveness, the divisiveness today is a really radical change from that time.
Mm-hmm. But there are other aspects about how he lived his life. You know, his devotion to his family was always on his sleeve. He never had to guess how he felt about his wife and his children. And living life to the fullest, I mean, I just used to get a kick how he used to jump out of airplanes well into his
80s. Yeah, he did that several times. I was not aware of that. Of course, I knew about it when he was 90, I think.
Yeah, it was his 90th birthday.
Yeah. Just four years ago.
He had plans to do it again next year.
Pretty amazing.
I'm not 90 and I wouldn't go jumping out of a plane.
And the colorful socks that he used to wear. He was well known for that. I guess he's going to be buried in some.
Yeah. He, an interesting guy. Very different mm-hmm. era. But I guess it's just that we can't help but contrast him with the current president and very different personalities.
That, and of course, time. I mean, there were a lot of things that happened during his presidency, perhaps, that, you know, caused him trouble. He obviously didn't win a second term. But when you're out of office for as long as he's been out of office, you know, time has a way to soften your reputation and your achievements while you were in office.
Yeah. And dulls the memories of the negatives. Absolutely. The party has changed, though. It's not just who's in charge of it, but the party has essentially changed as well. I mean, a year ago, him voting for Hillary Clinton and kind of bragging about it. And I'm wondering how much the party mourns his loss like it might have, you know, back in the day.
Well, John Kasich's general position is that the label of Republican is that the Republican, when we see polls that say a vast majority of Republicans support Donald Trump, he's saying that's a smaller pool than there used to be, that people aren't necessarily identifying as much with the label because it used to represent a certain platform and set of beliefs that you would fight for as part of your agenda. And getting that through was the main thing that people were working on, as opposed to a little bit of flat sort of by the seat of your pants, mm-hmm. Positions changing by the day, and
not
really
being fleshed out more than anything.
Right.
Yeah.
I think he was really devoted while in office to compromise, to he reached across the aisle. He wanted to come up mm-hmm. with deals that worked, that everyone, you know, could gather support from his opponents. And I think that was part of his downfall. I think some Republicans felt they didn't need to be that way and should push their agenda stronger than he was pushing their agenda. I think that's something that people will think about with him as well.
Mm-hmm. He worked on the Clean Air
Act. Right. Well, the Americans with Disability Act, I can still remember where I was in Cincinnati covering a Republican conference down in Cincinnati when that was signed into law on a summer day back in the day. And that was huge. I can't even imagine something like that getting through now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it was a time when we were seeing a lot of politicians who would come out and say, you know, after deliberation, I have changed my position on this, that, or the other thing. We've seen that in the state. We saw Rob Portman do that with gay marriage after one of his children
came out. Right,
came mm-hmm. out, and so I think that it still does happen with moderate politicians in both parties, but on the Republican side for sure. People are entrenched more now in their beliefs. They get very stubborn about where they are. Whereas when George H.W. Bush came in and he realized science and it was changing on the issues the party had cared about in terms of the environment, you know, mm-hmm. he was willing to work with the other party to cut a deal.
So his funeral's this week, and we'll look forward to that. I wanted to talk about this presidential thing going on with Sherrod Brown, the Democrat, and John Kasich, the Republican. Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer famously tweeted, he's running this week. And I'm like, what? I was out of town, and it was because Sherrod Brown had gotten his hair cut. And so why don't we tell people why that? What's the significance of that, Julie Carswife?
Well, if voters will recall that, you know, during this election, he boasted in one of his ads about how frumpy he was via an ad where everyone was talking about that, you know, he was disheveled but authentic as a person. And he showed up on the weekend TV shows with a nice looking short haircut. And
really short. I've never seen it that short before.
And the reason Jackie said he's running is because it looks, you could say it looks more presidential, more professional and less sort of Sherrod-ish. And
yeah, so disheveled.
Yeah, it's sort of like when Hillary got rid of the headband, you know,
right,
and decided that she was going to look a little bit more like a politician.
Yeah, a little more grown up, I guess, or something like that.
Right.
Although
right,
a good headband is worth its weight in gold. But I mean, Kathy, what do you think?
I think he's seriously interested in running. I think it's obvious, and he should be. He's a viable candidate. They gave him a look for the vice presidential spot under Clinton last time. I mean, he's from the state of Ohio. It's an important swing state, I think, still.
I think it is.
And, you know, why not? I mean, he's one of a lot of people that are going to be throwing their hat in, yes, seeing what they might be able to
do. He has a lot more room for his hat now.
Yeah, right. There's more room for it, too.
And you've got to wonder, if he had been the vice president with Clinton last time around, would the deplorables comment have played as much? Would the comment about mining have played as much? Because, you know, Sherrod's that working person's kind of, you know, he talks their language. So I could see him being the one sentence to Youngstown, Steubenville, those areas of the country where, you know, that plays exceptionally well.
A lot of times it's what is filling a vacuum. So after the Lordstown announcement by GM, mm-hmm, that they were shuttering the plant there and laying off 1,400 workers, one of the people that the president lashed out at and blamed for this decision was Sherrod Brown. And
that's,
I thought,
wild.
Well, what was that about? You know, and it just underscores that there must be some serious talk about it.
Right. And the interesting thing is, this was one area where Sherrod Brown, one of the most liberal senators, and the president were sort of seeing eye to eye. Both of them supported the tariffs, mm-hmm, with the idea that, you know, imported steel is hurting the American economy. And so they threw a few jabs at each other over this, because nobody wants to take credit for it, obviously. And everybody wants to say they're working hard to bring these kind of jobs back to Ohio, keep these jobs in Ohio, mm-hmm, keep manufacturing strong. You have the two pieces of it, the tariffs, but also, well, three pieces, because then you've got that the taxpayers of Ohio did support the bailout of the auto industry that saved those jobs once. Mm-hmm. And many people thought there were sort of bargains made there. But then you have this Republican tax package that, mm-hmm, was intended to help companies and get them to invest in this country. And that didn't really work either. So they're, well, you know, one was supported by Democrats, one was supported by Republicans, and GM's gone anyway.
And mm-hmm, Sherrod Brown, yeah, has an American Cars, American Jobs, I think that's the name of it, tax reform plan.
And he
out
talked
there
about it with the president, right?
Right, right. And basically the goal of that plan is to take away what he says are like half off coupons for companies who decide to send jobs overseas. He says that the changes that were made in tax reform last year, that those changes have actually encouraged companies to go build a plant overseas versus being here at home. So he says his plan is going to, if they would adopt it, it would change that. You know, of course, Sherrod Brown was not a big fan of the tax reform plan when it went through before. So, mm-hmm, I mean, you know, he's been critical about it all along. And Lordstown gave him an opportunity to say, you know, look, here's what I've been saying. We need to make changes, you know. And I think that's, you know, President Trump doesn't take well to anyone doing that kind of thing. But they are on the same page, like you said. They really are in some ways.
But is GM closing a few plants going to be enough of a springboard for him to run for president? I mean, it's a big issue here in Ohio, but when I think about across the nation, I'm not really, he's obviously going to have to come with more to the table.
We're going to talk about that more in our weekly reporter roundtable. It's Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Joe Engels of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau and Julie Carr Smythe, Associated Press State House correspondent. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. With me today, Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press, Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, and Joe Engels of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. We're talking, politics here as we're now in a lame duck session in the Ohio General Assembly. And there's things to talk about. Is the topic of Lordstown on the minds of anyone in the Ohio General Assembly, or is there not much they can do from that vantage point?
Well, I've seen some reporting around, you know, sort of what the state tried to do in the efforts.
The Ohio, Jobs Ohio?
Right.
Yeah.
And, did they do enough, that kind of thing? Obviously, they were created to move at the speed of business, to give corporations what they want. I mean, the conversation we're having today sort of does feel like, the entire political landscape needs to look at this sort of corporation issue, because we've got, during political election season, we've got, you know, there's the evil corporations or there's the corporations we've got to help. And they become this, we're not in agreement, I guess, as a society in terms of we hear a lot of bashing of corporations during election seasons. And then, of course, you know, a big corporation like GM, everybody relies on for jobs. And it feels like these divisions in politics are kind of causing some of this lack of maybe coordination on how do you help corporations and keep their jobs.
You know, for me, when I heard the Lordstown news, I kept thinking, and maybe it's because I have young millennials in my family, but I kept thinking this is yet another example of millennials, because a lot of millennials, they don't want to get their license. You know, we used to live to get our driver's license. I mean, we'd count the days off, right? Mm-hmm. And it used to be the big deal to get a car and drive up and down the strip of town and just stare at everyone. And, you know, that was huge, right?
Where'd you grow up?
Small town.
Small town. Washington courthouse.
But I know what you're talking about. Yeah, yeah, you've ever been stuck in a small town in Ohio on a Friday night.
Yeah, that was a Friday night. Yeah.
They used to drive circles.
Yeah. Be jealous, y'all. But anyway, we used to have a different relationship. Our generation has a different relationship with cars. And I know with my son, this is funny. You'll love the story. He moved out to Denver in March. We filled his car with gas before we left. When we went back out at the end of June, he was still on that same tank of gas that we put in it in March, because they don't like to drive. They either walk, they Uber, they, bicycle, they take a bus, there's out there, they have light rail, and they prefer that. That's what they prefer to do.
And that's a big generation of people that have less interest in buying cars.
So if they're not buying them, and you've got those of us who are getting older, we're a limited audience for a while. I mean, who's going to be buying all those cars in the future?
Also, that song, Forever Young, just sprung to mind, but go on. Let's take a call from Bryant in Grandview. Hi, Bryant. You're on the air.
Hello. A few comments. I agree with the millennial thing. I think that the problem with that, though, is the reason millennials are not buying cars is because they're not making the wages necessary to pay rent, to live, and to be able to buy a car.
Good point. The other point
I'd like to try to make is that I think GM is kind of like screwing the Ohio worker. There's other manufacturers of automobiles here in Ohio that are doing quite well, i.e. you got Honda in Marysville, Acura in Marysville. Mercedes-Benz is investing in building corporation factories here in the United States. So obviously there is a market. These other companies take pride in their workforce. GM treats everybody as they're disposable.
Yeah, well, GM does have a pattern of kind of stringing workers along. And apparently, we talked about the GM decision last week, and a lot of the people that worked there in Lordstown had been from other factories, other plants, mm-hmm. other parts of the country that had traveled there mm-hmm. and moved to Ohio from all kinds of places just to keep a job.
Well, it's interesting that GM is unionized and you know, I think in some ways they have impacted companies like Honda as they've come into the state and want desperately not to be unionized. That, you know, they work pretty hard to give workers what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting dynamic as, you know, we're looking at manufacturing shrinking and union shrinking. But the threat or whatever you want to call it, the opportunity for a union to come into a place has impacted the plight of workers in ways that are shifting as well.
Mm-hmm. You certainly don't hear a lot of talk about retraining these workers for the jobs
Not
that
like
GM
you used
does
to, right?
You know, GM's talked about having to shift their model. They want to get away, move to driverless cars and such. Well, they're going to need workers for that. But you certainly are not hearing any talk at all about retraining the people that are working now to take those new jobs, which I wonder if that's something we'll hear about coming down the road. I'm not going to hold your breath.
Okay.
No, I hope you're not holding her breath.
I'm not going to hold my breath. Don't hold yours either.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That was the authoritative voice of Kathy Kandinsky of Columbus Dispatch. Joe Ingles is with us from Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau and Julie Carr Smythe from the Associated Press. Were you going to say something, Joe?
No, oh, no. Okay. I was just being snarky here. Okay. Just ignore me.
Well, let's move on because this is an unfolding story with Lordstown, and we will continue to follow it as time goes on. But let's talk about this lame duck session. That's happening right now. Ohio House members have proposed a constitutional amendment that would make it harder to amend the state constitution. They didn't propose a constitutional amendment. They proposed a resolution, right, to make it harder.
Wouldn't it be an initiated?
They'd have to go through. Yeah. So why do they want to make it harder to amend the state constitution via statewide referendum?
Well, I guess I can start with that. A lot of times, and we've seen this in the last decade, when citizens want something done, and we'll take redistricting, for example. Citizens said they wanted redistricting. Citizens groups started first saying they wanted redistricting reform. And they kept pushing it and pushing it and pushing it. And the legislature wasn't reacting in the right way. And so they brought to the table several different proposals. And finally, through going to the voters, they were able to get the changes they want. You know, we're seeing it with medical marijuana. Mm-hmm. We're seeing it with and the lawmakers, sometimes it doesn't even take all these, you know, redistricting took several times to get it through, but sometimes it doesn't even take that. Sometimes it just needs a threat of having something go on the ballot, and lawmakers will react to that when they won't pass the bills on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, actually, the ballot has served as a checks and balances for a legislature that still at the state level is drawn heavily on party lines, and people are able to use the ballot as a way to get the will of the voters.
So the idea of changing this, the general argument though, is that those campaigns, we've seen a lot of out-of-state millionaires, billionaires come in and run these things this last cycle.
Mm-hmm.
We saw that the time before that. I mean, I wrote a profile of the two billionaires that were underwriting last year's two issues. And, you know, it from the standpoint of the lawmakers who are supporting this, they're saying, you know, this is not the policy that Ohio wants, and the money is coming from outside the state. Now, what usually these ballot, well, and they've failed pretty badly as well.
Mm-hmm. I think the voters know.
It's important to note, though, that they do require voter signatures from every county in the state, or mm-hmm. I forget what the requirements are, but the out-of-town interests can come in and fund the campaigns.
Right.
But they still require Ohio voters to sign the petition to get it going.
Right. Exactly. So and that's, you know, sort of the, although the money is coming in sometimes from well-funded interests such as, you know, Mark Zuckerberg or whoever, the bottom line is oftentimes they have polling on their side and public opinion on their side on these issues. I mean, and as Joe says, the electorate as a whole gets a chance to weigh in on these, and that it scares the lawmakers who know maybe they're passing public policy, for example, on abortion or guns or gambling or redistricting that people don't approve of.
Right.
I think it's
the majority.
Right. I think it's important to note that I just lost my train of thought. Sorry.
Okay, that's okay. This happens all the time to me.
I apologize.
All right, so what would this do? All right, so they have to get it on the ballot themselves. The Ohio General Assembly has to get this joint resolution on the ballot.
Ironically enough. But
and,
I mean, it's an easier path for them. So they have
all they have to do is pass it out of the – and it's
right.
Republican-controlled. Yeah.
Right. They have to do that, and then they put it before voters,
and then
to change it.
What will voters decide? Will voters decide to take away or limit their right to amend the Ohio Constitution?
It depends on how much money is spent to try to get passage of it. Who's spending that money, and the message that they put behind it? If they put the out-of-state interest or coming in, and they're trying to take away your voice, kind of thing, that could possibly play if there was enough. But then again, you know, I think Julie made the point that a lot of these efforts that have out-of-state interests behind them, those efforts have failed at the ballot box. So
I was going to say, it's hard to get a yes vote on these constitutional amendments traditionally.
Voters know when, you know, they usually are skeptical.
Correct. And I think the other side will say, hey, you know what? It's because of these constitutional amendments that we've been able to get some of the things that you voters like, you know,
medical marijuana.
Right.
Redistricting.
There's other people, though, that think that it's wrong to change the Constitution for these policy items, that the Constitution should have a much broader, you know, statements in it and not approving medical marijuana or things like that. And I think that's part of the support for this is coming from people that have that view as well.
Is this a lame duck issue, or do you think it's going to pop up again in the next General Assembly session?
I think they could pass it in this one.
Yeah.
Then it'll have to go through the voters, as you say. And it will be interesting to see if the campaign relates to the horrible defeats of a couple of these things. I mean, recreational marijuana went down very badly a few years ago. This last time there was an issue around drug sentencing and sort of lifting some of those sanctions to help reduce, you know, prison costs and that kind of thing. And that went down very badly, worse than the sponsors expected. You know, so they could feature that. But I don't know that those who are fighting this in the legislature, they have the bully pulpit, but do they have the actual big dollars behind them to run against such a campaign?
Right.
Yeah, but, you know, big dollars in this last campaign, we saw a lot of money on the no side. or on the yes side. We did see some money come in on the no side, but I think one of the persuasive things was pretty much the entire Republican Party adopted the no position on the last the mm-hmm. sentencing proposal that Julie's talking about. So I think that, you know, when you have well-organized grassroots opposition, too, that makes a huge mm-hmm. difference. Mm-hmm. And that clearly was something that was there.
Mm-hmm. The Ohio General Assembly, the Republicans in the Ohio General Assembly are working to freeze enrollment in the Medicaid expansion. John Kasich, Governor Kasich, has said that won't do. But Kathy Kandiski, what chance does he have?
Well, if the legislature decides to do it, they can certainly do it. The question is, will they have an over? I mean, he's right. certain to override it. So will they do it, or will they wait and do it next? You know, term
when
is a possibility
gone.
As well. But this has been an ongoing struggle between the Republicans and the legislature and John Kasich. I think it's a hard vote for the Republicans in the legislature because it seriously undermines our efforts to fight the opioid crisis. About half the people on Medicaid expansion are getting treatment for mental health and addiction issues. And so you freeze it, and you're obviously going to impact some of those folks.
Right, right.
So I think that's a really hard vote for people to take in this state in particular. We just came out last week. We're ranked number 2 in the country for opioid deaths. So where are you going to come up with the money to backfill that?
Mm-hmm. And some of these Republicans who were just up for reelection, they kept saying, you know what, we're all for you having insurance for pre-existing conditions and all these sorts of things. And, you know, they kind of went out there and embraced that for the public that elected them. So now are they going to turn around and freeze the Medicaid expansion, which basically is an outlet for a lot of people who
And by freezing it, what it does is it affects so many of those people who are in and out of Medicaid because they make too much
money.
They cycle on and off it all the time, and it would really change that dynamic a lot.
Correct.
There's about 700,000 people, a little less than that, that are insured through Medicaid expansion, single adults.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that the reason they're thumbing their nose at Governor Kasich right now is it's a little perplexing because they do have a Republican governor coming in, and they've passed now, or at least one chamber has passed, four different things that he has vowed to veto. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe this helps him on his presidential bid if he can say, look how I stood up to my own party and I want to run as an independent.
Well, right. Some are saying that they want to avoid throwing too many tough issues at Mike DeWine when he enters office, you know, just to give him a little bit of a break, because these are tough issues and there's a lot more to come. The lame duck session has only just begun.
Right.
So
I think they'll get it done if they feel they have the votes to override the veto. I think they'll go for it.
But it is important to point out that a vote for these things and a vote for a veto override are two very different votes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We've already been down this road with Medicaid once, and they opposed it. And then when it came back to a veto override, they didn't have the votes. They couldn't call the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
they all said, well, we did have the votes. We just decided not to call the bill. Mm-hmm. But usually if you have the votes, you call the bill.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. We will continue our conversation. They're listening to our weekly reporter roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher, and it is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Kathy Kandiski of the Columbus Dispatch, Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press, and Joe Engels of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. I want to make sure we've covered, you know, as much terrain as we need to regarding the lame duck session. Are you guys thinking it's going to go long? this year into the holiday?
No. Okay. I think the leadership has made it clear they want it over by the 15th, roughly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Two more weeks.
Yeah. 2 more weeks, which will feel like forever, but just 2 more weeks.
Yeah. 2 more weeks of
12 hours. One of the things
days.
I'm going to be watching for is if the legislature goes along with the State Board of Education's proposal to delay implementation once again of the new graduation requirements.
What do you think is going to happen?
I think they will. I think they're hearing a lot from local districts, local educators that are worried that too many kids aren't going to meet the graduation requirements and won't get a diploma this spring. So I would expect them to do that, but I haven't seen it pop up yet.
Hmm. What else?
The PBM issue. Is that going to happen, Kathy?
Pharmacy benefit managers, pay attention, please.
I'm sorry. We have the experts sitting right here. Kathy Kandinsky, what about pharmacy benefit managers?
I don't think the legislature is going to do. I mean, there's a bill that passed the House that is pending, that has moved to the Senate. But mostly, I think what's happening on this front is happening within the administration. The Department of Medicaid has changed the contracts to put more controls on the pharmacy middlemen that have been known to utilize spread pricing, which is a concept where they pay the pharmacist far less than what they're billing the state to fill prescriptions for Medicaid patients and pocket the money. The state's going to a new system that's going to prevent that. I think that's what we'll see happen. And then after we see how that goes, there could come back and be some legislation.
And that'll happen in lame duck?
No, that's going to happen. The administration's already put that into effect. It goes in January 1st.
Okay, I see. Yeah. Okay. All right.
And we very well could see the stand your ground, supposed people call it stand your ground legislation, that gun legislation come into play. I mean, it's already passed in one chamber. It's being considered in the other. Same with the heartbeat abortion bill. Mm-hmm. And that would ban abortion at the point when a fetal heartbeat can be detected about 6 weeks.
And these are two bills that Governor Kasich has said he would veto.
He says he'll veto them. And he has vetoed the heartbeat abortion bill before. And if you remember the last time it went around, they didn't have enough time. It was like, you know, calling people in over the holidays to take a veto vote. And that was, they said, well, we elected not to. But you got to wonder how many of those lawmakers said, you know what, I am not coming back from my vacation with my family and wherever to deal with that.
So. And that bill's passed the House, is pending in the Senate, but I don't think they've had any hearings yet.
Mm-hmm. What's changed, of course, since the election is Brett Kavanaugh having been appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right.
He's not more conservative than Scalia, but certainly there is a sense that maybe a challenge that would overturn Roe v. Wade would be.
He did replace Kennedy,
right,
who was
more swing vote.
Yeah, more of a swing vote, right.
Right, right. So those who support abortion limits have been using these bills and trying to hope they will overturn Roe v. Wade. The thing is that you have to have a legal challenge. And I'm wondering on the heartbeat bill, it's never made it into law here, but, you know, whether it's enforceable. Who would the complaint be against? Who would the violation be by? Who would actually cite a person for that violation? All those things are questions we haven't been able to answer because you'd have to make a lot of rules around that wouldn't probably come until the DeWine administration anyway.
Hmm. Yeah, and there was just a study that came out over the weekend in the Chicago Tribune about abortions, and the number of abortions in Illinois actually has gone up, and those are coming from out of state. People who are out of state who are going there to get around their own state's abortion laws. And so even if Ohio, you know, passed the heartbeat bill, you know, as Julie says, how would it be enforced? And would the enforcement just, you know, would people say, okay, I'm just going to go out of state? We already have groups in state that support abortion that help women go out of state. Would they be more likely to just, you know, I know they don't like this. None of the pro-choice groups like this legislation. Let me get on record saying that. Mm-hmm. But I could also see them say, you know, we're going to really put some emphasis in making sure that we have options for women to go out of state if they prefer.
It just sounds more like the 60s all the time.
It does. Well,
it does, doesn't it? History repeating itself.
Yeah. Well, there's some among the abortion opponents that don't like this bill either.
Right.
Which is interesting to see if with the change on the Supreme Court, whether their position will soften. And I guess I refer to the Ohio Right to Life, which was took no position on this bill.
They remain neutral on
the
bill. And we have a 20-week bill,
a ban
already in place, and that has not been challenged as of yet. So, you know, maybe the abortion rights groups are working or are deciding to really hold their fire here on this, if you will, just until they see what the impact is in terms of enforceability and, you know, if there's ever a violation.
I think the way the bill is worded, the enforcement would be against the doctor,
right,
not the woman, but the doctor would be subject to criminal charge if he violated the
right. And in the case of the reason I keep raising that question is that it would require the patient, I guess, to tell on her doctor, if you will, and to say, oh, he heard that
otherwise
heartbeat.
Otherwise, it's private.
Right. If he heard that heartbeat and he didn't tell you and I got that abortion. I mean, it's a very fuzzy enforcement mechanism that I'll be fascinated to see. It hasn't really stood up in any other state either so far. Mm-hmm. So if it can't be enforced, then do they want to risk, does somebody like Planned Parenthood want to risk suing and taking it to the new
Supreme
Court?
When do you think we see just an outright ban on abortion passed?
Is it Kansas? And there's in another state that there is a lawmaker working on that.
Well, we have a bill here in the legislature, and I can't remember the number because I'm not good with numbers, but it's a bill that would basically ban abortion. Mm-hmm. And it would also have penalties, a lot of penalties for doctors and people who facilitate to make it happen. This is sponsored by some of the more conservative members of the legislature. Mm-hmm. It's not expected to pass in the lame duck. It has had a hearing or two, but it's not that far along. But I know that the pro-choice groups are worried about it. They even took out a billboard across from the state house, one of those scrolling billboards on the buildings to put it on people's radar. And their concern is that it could really have the effect of putting women who have had a miscarriage or, something like that, putting them in situations where they could be prosecuted or where, a doctor could be prosecuted wrongly or something. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to make that statement. But like I said, that one's not expected to come through on lame duck session. But if the heartbeat bill does, how much longer would it be before that, before they start turning their
right.
Interestingly, the just a reminder, when you speak of the 60s and 70s, I mean, the Roe v. Wade ruling that people say legalized abortion, it was a privacy issue. It had to do with the balance between a person's personal privacy and the rights of the unborn, I guess. And so balancing that with the ban, with the inability to ban abortion in the first trimester. Am I right on that? Or the way through the second?
I thought it was through the second at the time, I think it changed.
Through the second trimester. But, sometimes we've seen fights in legislatures about the third trimester and universal legalization. And it's not really the case, at least under Roe v. Wade. I mean, individual states are rewriting that law all the time.
And even if Governor Kasich doesn't sign it, even if he vetoes it and it stays vetoed, Mike DeWine, Governor-elect Mike DeWine, has said
he would absolutely sign it.
So there's no question about that. There's another issue that's kind of out there. We still see the billboards. What's going on with the right to work law, which, of course, is the anti-union legislation, not unlike Senate Bill 5 from, 7 years ago, which would have affected public employee unions.
That has, calmed down considerably since Senate Bill 5 time. And, you know, if you look at the donors to the Republicans, you'll see a lot of union representation on there. They give, you know, it used to be that the unions just supported the Democrats mainly. But in recent years, we've seen more unions supporting the Republicans as well. And, you know, that's going hand in hand with not pushing as hard. Now, that being said, there are always proposals in the legislature to basically make Ohio a right-to-work state. And they'll
again, we call it right-to-work, but it would ban organized labor.
It would make it so that you wouldn't have to pay into a union to be able to work a particular job. So if you didn't want the union representing you, you could elect not to pay into it and still get that job. Basically, you know, the unions have been against this, saying that it would definitely hurt the workers and their rights, and they'll still fight it. I mean, there's still a lot of will to fight this thing. But the most recent efforts have been with private companies and private workers. So, you know, if you remember, Senate Bill 5 was public workers.
Right.
And so recently they've kind of gone into the private workers. But it just hasn't had the traction that it needs. And you've got to wonder if that's not due to the unions kind of saying, hey, Republicans, you know, here's why
you
shouldn't pass that.
I think Governor Kasich recently said it was his biggest regret in office was Senate Bill 5, which is understandable the way the backlash was on that.
There, of course, there was the ballot issue that was
repealed.
Just repealed it.
And
talk about the
unions,
voters speaking on in the ballot.
Right. We have seen labor endorse and back candidates of both parties more and more, maybe more and more, but certainly in the last two election cycles, you know, candidates of both parties have gotten their support. So it's not as if that's just a one party.
They've also been the labor unions have been influential in stopping any changes to the unemployment compensation system that
That's
they've
right.
been dealing with for a couple of years now.
I just wanted to correct myself. I think now, you know, lack of coffee, I think Roe v. Wade is through viability.
Okay.
Right, which
All
is
right.
not necessarily defined, and I think that's one of the sticking points. If I'm wrong, I'm sure your listeners will tell you.
Correct us.
They're going to tell you. They're going to come to your house.
let's see. Governor Kasich, I mean, he told Kieran Kassler of Ohio Public Media.
Ohio Public Radio and TV.
Public Radio and Television, that he's seriously considering another run for president.
Yep.
He's really unhappy with what he sees in the country. He hasn't decided what he wants to do about it yet. What's new? This sounds like the same thing he's been saying for the last 2 years.
But he also told Karen that he wasn't planning on running if he ran. He's not planning on running as an independent.
And what does that tell you?
So that tells
There's
me
There's no way to win as an independent.
Right. And that's true. There really isn't an apparatus for an independent to be able to win. But beyond that, that tells me that he's sitting there waiting for the public to kind of swing away from Donald Trump. And we've got a lot of things out there that are going to be, you know, with the Democrats coming in, probably the first thing we're going to see is a massive investigations into different things that involve President Trump, right?
Some stuff, massive is this big word, but...
Well, I think we could see a lot. Yeah. I mean, we could see maybe even a dozen, you know, which I think is massive in terms of investigations.
Right.
But, you know, we're going to see these new things happen, and we've already got the Mueller investigation that they're looking at. We've already, you know, they're looking at all these ties in Russia with President Trump and... And we saw last week where Michael Cohen, who was the president's fixer, he, you know, pled guilty. So there's a lot of things happening. And I think John Kasich is just waiting to see how that plays out.
Right. I think it's two things. As Joe says, either the electorate goes away from Trump or Trump implodes. And if neither of those things happens, I don't see him having a path.
A real clear path. Well, we're out of time for now. Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press, thanks for joining us today, as always.
Thanks for having me.
And Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, thanks to you as well.
Always fun to be here.
And Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks, everybody else, for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.